I'm the co-founder and CEO of Ketamine Clinics Los Angeles. We've been doing IV infusions of ketamine since 2014. We were one of the first in the country to start offering this treatment. I co-founded the clinic with my father, Dr. Steven Mandel. And when we first started, this was seen as a very radical thing. And people were saying that it should be an absolute last resort. And we knew then that that wasn't the case or that shouldn't be the case, but that was the consensus. Now, fast forward 10 years, it's become much more mainstream and much more widely adopted, even though it's still something that most people don't really know very much about, or they have misinformation. And so, a big part of what we do is we try to just, help to create more awareness. And with that, though, the treatment has also really moved up the ladder in the treatment algorithm, if you will, of kind of when you should have it. And some people, a lot of people still have this, idea that it is only for really extreme cases. And I really want to let people know that's not the case. Because ketamine infusions work very quickly, usually within hours to days. They work very safely. They have none of the side effects that conventional antidepressant pills have. SSRIs, SNRIs, antipsychotics, anti-anxiety medications, has none of those side effects such as weight gain, loss of libido, dry mouth, blurred vision, increased suicidality, and the whole list of other side effects that these traditional medications typically have. And it's extremely effective. In our clinic, it works 83% of the time. So it really is, in my opinion, the best depression treatment that we have available today. It also really helps to treat the root cause of the issue as opposed to just covering symptoms, which most of these prior medications and treatments really do. Is they're not really getting at the root cause of the issue. We can talk more in a minute about kind of how ketamine does that. But your question of kind of who should have it, when should they have it? If you have a clinical diagnosis of depression, PTSD, anxiety, suicidal thinking, and several other mood disorders, and especially if you've already tried at least one or two of the conventional treatments, therapy, some prescription medications like one or two different SSRIs, and you haven't gotten a benefit, or your benefit has been unsatisfactory, or you've had side effects that are intolerable, then you're an ideal candidate for this treatment. But I just want to emphasize, you don't have to have severe depression. You don't have to be suicidal. You don't have to have suffered for 10, 20 years. You can have this treatment much closer to a first line treatment, or even as a first line treatment if that's something that you want. We do have patients who don't want to go on pills for all the reasons I mentioned. The side effects, those pills often take 4 to 6 weeks to start working, often longer. You're trialing different dosages, maybe combining other medications, trying different types within a class or different classes of medicines to find what might help you. And that can be a lengthy, expensive process in terms of your visits to your doctor, the cost of the medication. And then very uncomfortable for people. So more and more people are realizing I want to just have the infusions without taking, 3, 6 months, a year of doing this other stuff and then having them afterwards anyways.
Sam, we've met a bunch of people who talk about depression and anxiety and the side effects of traditional SSRIs. I mean, it seems like traditional SSRIs, they kind of blunt you a bit. I've heard people say that, like, even the way they see colors or the way they hear music or the way they feel things, just becomes a lot less, and by extension, their life becomes less full, It's just they're living a smaller, narrower version of their life. And also that they're so dependent on it and you can't really escape traditional SSRI meds. You're supposed to be on it for as long as possible, and upping dosages and stuff. And then here comes ketamine out of nowhere, and it gives you, let's say, an experience, and it helps relieve you of your depression, and you take less and less of it the more you feel better, and you're not on it for life, and you can feel better. I mean, it's incredible, honestly, the power of
It really is.
ketamine.
It really is.
I'm just comparing the two, And it just, it's so sad for me to see people who are so sad and depressed, and they're seeking help and they're asking for help. And traditional psychotherapists are just giving them these pills, knowing of all these side effects. Meanwhile, you have ketamine right there, readily available.
Yeah.
So what's going on?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. First of all, yes, it's very common for patients to report that the depths of their depression, the kind of floor, if you will, has been raised when they take SSRIs. They don't feel as bad. Maybe they can function better, though the ceiling of their joy and their experience mm-hmm. of life has been lowered. And they're in this narrower field of operating, feeling flat, numb, not experiencing pleasure. And this is not what we consider success. This is not what we desire for our patients. This is not what most people desire for themselves. So this kind of flattening effect is a very counterproductive thing. Obviously, if you have somebody who's bedridden or unable to function and they can take these medicines, they can get back to work or they can be more engaged with their family, that's definitely good. That matters, right? But it's not a victory, really. If you can have something that can actually restore pleasure and give you energy and motivation and help you to really be fully engaged in the full range of the human experience. And so, you know, to your question, well, what's going on here? This is where it's important for people to have some context on the history of ketamine and the politics, mm-hmm. really, that are at play here. Because when a lot of people hear us talk, they go, wow, if it's so great, how come it's not the main thing everyone's using or doing? Or how come I've never heard of it? And ketamine is an FDA-approved anesthetic. It was FDA-approved mm-hmm. in 1970. It's been around mm-hmm. since the 60s. This is an old medicine we've had for 50-plus years. And it's among the most widely used anesthetics in the world. And it's also used in veterinary medicine. So a lot of people know of it as a horse tranquilizer or a cat mm-hmm. tranquilizer. And they go, how can you give that to people? Well, it's a human anesthetic. A lot of medicines are used in both human and veterinary medicine. Mm-hmm. It's also an analgesic. It's a pain reliever. It can be used instead of opioids in certain situations in the ER or in other matters if you're injured in an accident or something like that. It's also a drug that's used recreationally, Special K, same drug. Mm-hmm. So again, people go, oh yeah, like I know people who snort that at parties. You're giving that to people for mood disorder treatment? What are you talking about? That's crazy. Yeah, mm-hmm. This is a really ubiquitous drug with a lot of different uses. Well, in the last 20 plus years, it's been proven as really among the best, if not the best, antidepressant medications and other mood disorder treatments when it's used intravenously through sub-anesthetic doses, much smaller doses than are traditionally given for sedation. So, that's a little context about this drug. Now, it's important to note that the use of it for mood is what's called off-label. And it just is basically saying that any doctor can prescribe any medicine for anything they want if they feel there's a good basis to do so. So ketamine is approved as an anesthetic, but using it for mental health is off-label. And so the FDA approves a medicine, not just says this medicine's approved, use it, but for a specific use, specific condition, in a particular patient population. And there's a lot of specific requirements about what that approval means. So, off-label use is extremely common in the United States. 1 in 3 of all psychiatric medications are prescribed off-label. And wow. 1 in 4 almost of all prescriptions are prescribed off-label. So science is constantly finding ways that medicines can be helpful in addition to what they were initially created for. However, I mention all this because the insurance networks in this country mm-hmm. will use that as a reason not to pay for treatment. They'll say this is experimental. It's not FDA approved for this indication. It's not experimental. There's been 180 clinical trials proving the safety and efficacy of ketamine for mental health. About 70 of them have results published available for viewing online. Now you can go to clinicaltrials.gov, type in ketamine for depression. They're there. You can read them for yourself. Dozens of them are peer-reviewed. They're at leading institutions. We're not talking about, Sally and Joe went out and put out a study. I mean, we're talking the top-level universities like USC, UCLA, Stanford, Harvard, NYU, the National Institute of Mental Health, Cleveland Clinic, Johns Hopkins. And the list goes on and on and on. So this is way beyond anecdotal. This is not experimental. But the insurance companies don't want to pay for things. So they use that as a reason not to pay. And because of that, a lot of patients don't find out because they're very focused on using the insurance they have for the care that they need. Totally. Doctors as well are very focused on trying to help operate within this system that they are a part of for the payer networks and also what their patients want to be able to use their insurance. So these are some of the reasons. And also ketamine, because it's an old medicine, the patent is up. So no one really makes money on the sale of ketamine. It's a cheap generic drug at this point. And it's manufactured by about a half a dozen different people in the US alone. When I say people, I mean, you know, companies. So with other drugs that are name brand, that, you know, like say, you know, Wellbutrin or something like that. Now, a lot of the common SSRIs are also off patent or can be made with generics as well now. But when they first come out and for many years, you have big pharma heavily marketing and promoting their drug because they're going to make, it's a high margin for them to make money with. And so they run their commercials, they take doctors out to fancy dinners and, you know, come to their offices and say, hey, let me tell you about this amazing drug and why you should be prescribing it to your patients. And they send them information and they kind of convince them. And, you know, there's a huge machine around this from big pharma and, you know, politicians that get involved in pushing these, you know, profitable drugs into the hands of the individual patient. And no one is doing that for ketamine. There is no big push for it because no one can get paid on it. So they're focused on the things they make money on. So healthcare in this country, as many people are starting to realize, is not what the latest, greatest treatment is, not the best chance of you having a better life. The healthcare in this country is about what's going to make the most money for the people who are running the show. And they're very much embedded with the politicians who are passing the laws and lobbying and making things easy for them to get paid. So it's a really sad and unhealthy system that's led to a sick country, medically and mental health wise. And we have this mental health crisis that gets worse and worse every single year. But these are some of the nuances of understanding the system that I think people need to know in terms of why their doctor, their psychiatrist, the people who are supposed to really be giving them the best chances of success in their life are not talking about ketamine. They're not educated on ketamine. Some of them are even anti-ketamine.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's really interesting. Yeah. And I agree with you on the very shoddy healthcare system that exists in the US. It's very profit based and it's nothing similar to the one that we have here in the UK, like in Europe in general. I wanted to ask your opinion on that. Do you think that maybe the US should convert their healthcare system to something similar to what the UK has or like Europe?
Yeah, I don't know a lot about the UK health system, but the idea of like universal healthcare, the idea of more government involvement and ensuring, you know, more equitable access and better quality care, absolutely. As long as profit is the number one priority in our system, which it is, we're never going to have a system that's actually healthcare. We're going to have a system. I mean, the US spends more money on healthcare than like the next 20 countries combined, and we have terrible outcomes. If we were doing that and having the best outcomes, maybe we'd say, hey, we're doing okay, but let's try to, you know, scale back a little bit so we're not spending so much, but let's keep up the great results. We're not. We're way down on the list. I mean, I don't want to make things up. I don't know the exact place off the top of my head right now, but we're really low on the list of overall health outcomes, but we're number one in expenses. That doesn't make sense, you know, and as long as that continues, it's a problem. And so the money is there, and we spend so much money on our military, and we spend so much money on bombing people and on all kinds of things. You know, we have, you know, trillions of dollars of debt. I mean, we go into deep debt for so many things, but yet our healthcare seems to just continue to fall to the wayside and be seen as something that isn't worth investing in or taking care of. And so, yeah, when you have for-profit companies who are focused on giving dividends and returns to their shareholders and their investors, and that's their only priority, something needs to change. And I do believe in a free market and the market kind of, you know, dictating how things need to go, let the consumer let you know, and the market responds accordingly. But in this case, and in some cases, it's a big enough issue and it's not really going very well for anyone, except for the small handful of people who are raking in the cash. I think the government needs to get involved, and there needs to be more equitable access. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So where does that leave ketamine right now in terms of the legality of it? I mean, you've been working in it 2014. Has it not been approved in 2019? FDA approved for?
No. So, so ketamine was synthesized in the 60s, FDA approved in 1970. It's been around since. The nasal spray Spravato or S-ketamine was approved in 2019.
Gotcha.
And that's what Janssen Pharmaceuticals did, who was then later wholly acquired by Johnson & Johnson.
Gotcha.
Because everyone was talking about how amazing ketamine is. And they were like, how can we make money on this? And there's no way to make money with ketamine. Because I said, the patent's up, it's cheap, it's a generic. So they said, okay, here's what we're going to do. Ketamine is two isomers, like mirror image molecules, left and right. Okay, left hand, right hand. They're going to say, we're going to take the left isomer, S-ketamine, which is basically half of the racemic mixture that makes up ketamine. And then we're going to put it into a nasal spray. And then we're going to have a number of requirements that will make this product unique enough to us that we can own it. And they got that approved. And so we have Spravato now, which is a nasal spray. It's about half as effective as IV infusions of ketamine. And not because the molecule is so much less effective, but because than the two together, but because of the route of administration. Nasal is not a good way to take medicine. Really any medicine. And in this case, especially with regards to mental health treatment and the mechanism of action that's so effective for ketamine, that's all the research is on, is a steady, continuous, gradual infusion for 40 minutes. In my clinic, we do 55 minutes. We have a longer infusion. We give a little more medicine. We get better results. But it's this steady, continuous journey and experience of the medicine and 100% bioavailability and the ability to adjust the dosing up or down as needed during an infusion or from one to the next with great precision is what really makes it therapeutic. So Spravato, though, is approved specifically for depression. And as a matter of fact, it's been wildly successful for them this year. It was a very slow product to launch. They really kind of didn't think through a lot of things and they struggled with it. And now it's doing very, very well for them. You know, Spravato is actually not necessarily a bad product when you especially compare it to conventional pills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But when you, if you're talking about it versus IV infusions, it's night and day. There's no comparison at all. And it's frustrating to see it take on so much growth when it takes a lot longer, doesn't work as well, does have more side effects, is more prone for abuse and addiction potential, and is much more expensive. It costs like $1,000 per treatment for the insurance companies are picking up a lot of this bill. But this is what's so crazy. They'll pay $1,000 for a treatment for Spravato, which is half as effective, but they don't want to pay $500 or $600 for an IV infusion for someone. I mean, it doesn't make sense. And that's because they have the FDA approval and they have the lobbying arm and they have the money and they have the connections.
So is this why they use nasal sprays when they're getting high at festivals?
Yeah. So,
I'm serious. It's like sometimes I've seen people like popping a nasal spray when they look high as fuck.
Yeah, so that's probably not Spravato because there's a REMS program in place that's pretty strict about ensuring it's only done in the clinic. And I think it's pretty hard to get it out of the clinic. But there's also just the generic ketamine nasal spray. And some people do get that prescribed for home use, and it's made by a compounding pharmacy. And more commonly, what I think people are doing is they're buying ketamine on the street. And they're getting it in powder form. And, you know, most of the time when people use it recreationally, they snort it. And then what they're doing is they're putting it in, they're making their own nasal spray with like purified water and just a regular inhaler. And so that they can use it in that way. So I think most of what you see when you see that in those environments. But yeah, the mechanism of action is that rush And yeah. It hits, you know, when it hits you like that, when you're snorting it, it also, there's some indication it could act on opioid or other receptors differently mm-hmm. than when you get it through other routes of administration. And so that can definitely, you know, the good thing is ketamine is not physically addictive. And this is something that some people have concern about in getting treatment. It's not gotcha. Addictive like an opioid, like alcohol or nicotine. You're not going to get a physical dependency on it. But you can use it to escape, just like you can use ice cream or chocolate or sex to escape, you know, mm-hmm. so people can use it to try to escape. Mm. And some people use it in unhealthy ways, but it's not inherently an addictive drug. But when you're using it that way, snorting it, spraying it up your nose, the effects are much more, it can definitely make you more predisposed to kind of using it in an unhealthy manner. Because, you know, like we were talking about at the very beginning, we all have hard times, we'll have stressful days, sad days, we can be angry, right? And sometimes if yeah. you can just push a button and make it go away, it can start to get Woo! Kind of tempting to do that. You know what I mean? And so just squirt, squirt, oh, I'm feeling a little bit better now. That's not healthy, right? And so that's the other thing about having ketamine in the clinic with IV is we're in control. It's measured, it's clinical, you know, physicians are monitoring it. And it doesn't necessarily, it's not as likely for people to start to create habits around being able to relieve themselves from a stressful day just with, you know, with a push of a button. Yeah. Which obviously, mm-hmm. and fill in the blank, it's not just ketamine. It's not going to do that with anything. Right. I think that's a big part of what healthy habits are, is just learning how to work within sometimes challenging experiences and not trying to escape, because that's never going to be good, whatever your source of escape is.
And totally. Sam, if you don't mind me asking, I know you mentioned that you have an 83% success rate in your clinic. That's a very high margin. That's amazing. But I want to play devil's advocate and ask, for the 17%, what happens to those people, and what exactly is the issue with the 17%?
Well, I hope you're not the father whose child brings home a 98% on the test and you say, well, what happened to those other 2 points? You know, but no, it's a fair question. 83% is really high. And we mostly treat treatment-resistant patients. So they've tried, you know, at least a handful of other things and not benefited from them. Many of them have tried everything out there. I mean, not everything. I mean, almost everything out there. Even sometimes ECT, you know, shock therapy and other more, you know, kind of invasive things. So it really Wow. works even when nothing else does. However, it does not work for everyone. It's not a cure. It's not a permanent solution. There is no such thing. So I just want to be clear about that. And it's not a magic bullet. People still need to do the work. They got to take care of themselves and have a healthy wellness and engage in talk therapy and, you know, all the things. And we can talk more about what some of them are later if you'd like. But to answer your question, we don't know why the 17% don't benefit. That would be a million, maybe even $1 billion answer. What we do know is that sometimes if there are vitamin or hormonal deficiencies, that can actually contribute to depression and other issues, and it can also prevent you from benefiting from the treatment. So we had a patient who had very, very low testosterone levels. He had tried a handful of infusions, not benefited, but was really committed to giving it a full chance to work for him and really believed in it despite not benefiting. We later found out he had extremely low testosterone. He had that corrected. And then he resumed treatment and he had a wonderful result. So one of the things that we tell people, really interesting stuff. So, and this can happen with vitamins and other, you know, minerals as well. So one of the things that we tell people, and we don't want to take time or money to screen up front, but if people don't benefit, we will definitely say you should have a comprehensive lab work done and we should check this stuff out. However, that's not the only reason or even necessarily the main reason people don't benefit, but it's something to be aware of. Why, we don't really know. That's pretty much all I can say. I mean, I don't think there's really much to say about why. It's just, you know, nothing works for everyone every time, and science is going to continue to look into that.
Do you want to tell us a bit more about, you can continue, Sam.
Yeah, sorry to cut you off. I will just add quickly that there are, there's an interesting trend we're seeing of late responders and of people who need more treatments. And we do a series of 6 infusions over 3 weeks. Each infusion is about an hour. And people usually start to feel better after the second or the third. So within a matter of days, maybe within 1 week, they're feeling a lot better. And sometimes it can be hours after the very first infusion. That's not typical, but it's definitely possible.
Yeah.
Because the treatment has a reputation for being so fast to work, some people have that expectation where they go in and they have one and they say, oh, I tried one and I don't feel better. It doesn't work. That's not what it's about. You got to give it a chance. Okay. You have to have a series, at least 3 or 4 infusions before you make a determination. However, we have had people have 2 or 3 and they say, I don't want to take any more time or money. It hasn't helped me yet. I'm going to stop. And I find that troubling because we are seeing an increasing trend of people, especially really treatment resistant people, who actually will have a full series of 6 infusions, have very, very little to no benefit. And then a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks later, start to notice a lot of improvement and changes and feel a lot better. So there's this kind of delayed response. And also same for people who just, you know, most people can feel a lot better after the third infusion, but the people who need the 5th or the 6th, and maybe it's that day on their 6th or the day after their 6th, they start to feel a lot better. And so we don't really fully understand why. I can tell you one thing, you know, about the mindset that I think is a factor in this, because we don't really understand fully the brain chemistry as to like what's going on and why. But on the mindset side of things, a lot of people are so depressed for so long, it becomes a part of their identity. And it is so ingrained in them. They're not somebody who struggles with depression. They are a depressed person. That's who they are. And their life is very much revolving around that identity. So when that starts to go away, it can be hard for people to actually adjust their self view and their world view that this is actually different now. They kind of hold on to it. We've had people say, you know, oh, I don't really think I'm any better. And we say, oh, well, your depression assessments are a lot better. Your wife said you took her out to dinner for the first time in 2 years. She said you're smiling more and actually laughing at some jokes. But obviously we want you to feel better, but just some of these other things are good context as to maybe you're actually doing a little bit better than you think you are, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's very interesting and it can take time for people to readjust, recalibrate. And when you mention these things, then they'll often go, oh yeah, yeah, you're right. I guess maybe I am, but they don't really feel it. You know what I mean?
They don't notice the progress they're making. And that's why talk therapy, I think combined with the ketamine therapy really helps. Like talk therapy really, because like you're basically repeating you're doing positive reinforcement to these depressed people and you're showing them the way that the progress that they're doing, the results is actually there. Because depressed people are usually very hard on themselves. They're very self-critical. They just have this constant voice in their head saying they're shit, they're bad, they're not good enough. So even if they are making progress with whatever treatment they're doing, they're just going to say, yeah, it's not enough. They have very high expectations for some reason.
Yeah. The kind of primary descriptors that are very common among depressed patients are that they feel hopeless, helpless, and worthless. And that's all a lot to overcome for sure. And I think your insight on that is definitely very good. Yeah. And, you know, that negative thinking is something that the ketamine really quiets during infusions. The quieting of the, you know, default mode network of the chatter in the mind, negative self-talk, clearing that out, creating almost a stillness and space for other thoughts, feelings, realizations to occur. And we all have that in our head. You don't have to be a depressed person to have that. It's a part of the human experience. For some of us, it's much worse than others. It's much darker than others. It's much more intrusive than others. And that quieting of that really creates opportunity for healing for people.
That's very true.
So take us through what someone goes through. Someone's depressed. They ask for your help. You go to the clinic. Maybe you do like a little talk therapy session first, and then they start doing the ketamine treatment. How does the ketamine treatment work?
Yeah, so we don't do talk therapy in-house. We refer out for it. We're big advocates of it. Most of our patients are already working with someone. If not, we refer them to someone. There are places that are doing therapy in conjunction with the treatment, even at the same time as the treatment. We really like to give patients and feel there's a lot of value in giving patients their own space to have an inner journey. And the amount of medicine we use is not really conducive to talking. And the experience is really outside of language. So giving patients the chance to have this, journey and process, and then to later discuss it with someone, we feel for most people, most of the time, is really much better. Mm-hmm. And what's going on? So ketamine is really powerful because it's unique to anything else. And it has a two-pronged approach. One is on the neurochemical effects on the brain. And then the other is the experiential or psychological effects on the mind. So neurochemically, there's a lot going on. I don't know how much, into the weeds of it you want me to go, but basically it helps to promote neurogenesis, increase neuroplasticity. It increases proteins like brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF. It's an NMDA receptor antagonist. By blocking that, it creates an increase in release and production of the neurotransmitter glutamate. Glutamate is associated with mood and energy. And so there's a lot of, chemical processes going on here with the medicine during the journey that last long after the medicine has left the body. SSRIs and other pills, you have to take them every day because if you don't maintain the blood level, they stop working. Well, ketamine, as we've established, you have your series of treatment and then you don't have treatment for 3, 4, 5, 6 months or even longer sometimes before coming back for follow-up. And it's not that the medicine lasts really long in the body. No, ketamine has a very short half-life. It's completely out of your system in like a day or so. I mean, the half-life is about, I want to say around like 6 or 8 hours or something like that. So, a day, it's like gone. But the effects that happen while it's in the body can be persistent and long-lasting because it's actually making structural changes in the brain. Mm-hmm. It's increasing dendrite density and connectivity. You can see physical growth in the prefrontal cortex. It's helping your neurons to fire and wire together better and to create new neural connections. So this is powerful stuff. This is not just a Band-Aid or just getting high here, what we're talking about. And then there's also the psychological experience. So it is a psychedelic. It's a dissociative anesthetic, and it's also psychedelic. So people have these journeys that can have a huge range of experiences, but it often looks like a separation of the mind and body to get a unique and kind of objective view of yourself and your life and your past, your negative ways of thinking, of being, your patterns, the people in your life, your history, maybe past trauma. Many, many people have trauma in one form or another. I would say probably most people, if not all. It doesn't have to be that you went to war and saw combat, though that's obviously an example we think about a lot when we think of trauma. It could be much smaller things than that. Family, unhealthy family dynamics at home, or, living in fear or feeling neglected or, not accepted in socially or, whatever, all kinds of different situations that can come up for people that can be traumatizing for them in life. But they're able to get a unique perspective on this and think through it and sort through it in their mind in ways that can be very healing for them to have process and closure. And a lot of this stuff, especially when it's really upsetting for people, they don't want to think about it, or they can't, or it's repressed, or they have a really extreme, a very, very emotional response to it, which is not allowing them to really work through it. And ketamine allows for them to revisit this trauma without being as triggered by it, which is really important. The past is the past, right? It's set in stone. It's never going to change. But our perception of it, the story that we tell ourselves about it, can change indefinitely. So people have this opportunity to recognize, what really happened and their part in it, and to forgive, have more compassion for themselves, more compassion for others, and to really lay it to rest.
And Sam, I know we've been talking about the mental effect ketamine has on people. But have you also treated people with, for example, chronic pains or physical pains with ketamine?
Yeah. It's very, very good for true CRPS, complex regional pain syndrome, for neuropathic pain, trigeminal neuralgia, migraines. It's not good for acute pain. It's not good for anatomic pain. It is in the sense that if you give someone some ketamine, it'll take the pain away. But as soon as the ketamine wears off, the pain will come back. Just like, you know, any kind of pain reliever. So, you know, if you're in the ER, you're in an accident, you're in the back of an ambulance. Yeah, it would be, you know, you have an injury or something. Yeah, it could be great to get some ketamine then to take the pain away. But it's not a, that's not a long-term solution. But for true CRPS, it can help for months and months of relief from some treatment. It's not as effective as it is for mood, maybe around 70%. We've done a fair amount. It's not as much of a focus for us anymore. It helps with resetting pain receptors in the brain, like a process as well known as central sensitization. And over time, these pain receptors increase in number and in their amplification of the pain. And especially with opioids, actually opioids can cause this effect. And it's why a lot of people end up on really dangerously high doses of opioids, because they keep taking them, the pain gets worse, they, their body starts to adjust, the pain levels get louder, they start yelling more and more and firing more frequently. So you take some more opioids and so on, and it's this negative feedback loop. So ketamine helps to reset that. We do, the protocol is different. We do a series of 5 infusions over 5 days or over, you know, 6 or 7 days. And they're 4 hours long and they're much higher dose. They can be anywhere from 2 to 3, you know, 2 to 3 times as much medicine. So it's a lot. It's a totally different kind of process. CRPS, for people who don't know, I mean, it's a horrible condition. There's no treatment for it. And, you know, people can have a traumatic injury that even after it's healed, they still have a tremendous amount of sensitivity and pain in that area. So if you break your arm in a motorcycle accident and, you know, the arm, the bone heals and everything looks good under x-ray and everything like that, but you still feel a lot of pain there. That could be CRPS or neuropathic pain. And for some people, it's just awful. I mean, it's horribly debilitating to the point where even just laying in bed, the sensation of bed sheets against the skin can be extraordinarily painful for people.
Yeah.
It's an awful, awful thing. And ketamine can really, really help with that.
Wow.
Wow.
I want to ask you about, for me, one of the reasons I would think someone would be hesitant to try ketamine therapy is that psychedelic experience. I mean, someone who comes from a more traditional background, never tried psychedelics, maybe is afraid of it because of their upbringing or such, or afraid of the bad trip concept, that they might have a bad trip or so. Okay. And I'm sure you've been asked this before. So how would you, how do you respond when someone asks you about the trip part? They want the benefits of ketamine, the neurological benefits, but the tripping, may be a bit aversive.
Yeah. So we have patients who have used, you know, lots of psychedelics before, and we have patients who've never done any drug and don't drink, and everything in between. Men, women, you know, non-binary, young, old, you know, all races, backgrounds. I mean, we have a very diverse group of patients. So people need to know they're in a safe environment. We monitor them. We monitor their vitals with hospital grade equipment, their pulse ox, EKG, their blood pressure. We have really compassionate, trained team. This isn't going off and taking acid in the woods with some people and just hoping that you get into trouble, you know? So even though it's, yes, it has psychedelic properties, it's not going to be an out of control experience. And of course, there's always the fear of the unknown, and there's a fear of kind of what might come up or how you might feel. But we are holding space for patients. You know, the clinical team is fantastic. And we also have relaxing medicine if we need it. You know, normally we don't like to use it, but if we need to provide like a benzo to help for people to relax if they're feeling anxious, I mean, that's an option. They also need to know that the IV infusion, one of the really great advantages to it is it can be turned off at any time. And the medicine actually starts to leave the body very, very quickly. So whereas if you snort it, if you have a lozenge or a trochee that dissolves under the tongue, if you have an IM injection intramuscularly, These are all other ways that people are using ketamine clinically and recreationally. Once you put squirted that medicine all into the muscle as a shot all at once, once that lozenge under your tongue is fully dissolved, once you've snorted that line or that nasal spray squirt, it's gone. Like that medicine, you're not getting out of your body until it wears off on its own. With an IV infusion, like I mentioned earlier, where it's a continuous steady rate that's very slow. And when if we need to lower it so the experience is less intense, we use digital syringe pumps. And we can do that with the push of a button. And we don't even use an IV bag. So it's really precise. And within minutes, the change is felt. Same thing if people aren't quite going deep enough into the experience or feeling it enough, we can increase it. And if it's really upsetting for someone, which it almost never is to this point, we can turn it off. And again, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, literally, I mean, with each passing minute, you're going to start to feel it wearing off. 20, 30 minutes, the effects are almost entirely gone in terms of the dissociative experience. And then you might feel a little groggy, maybe a little dizzy or a little unsteady on your feet for a few hours, but you're back. And you're talking and you know what's going on. By the way, even during the infusion, you're not so out of it that you don't know what's going on. You know, most people, most of the time, you can orient yourself to the room. You know, you can, we give them pillows, blankets, noise-canceling headphones, a sleep mask, a very comfy recliner. They lay back and they have this experience. But they can lift up the sleep mask and look around the room a little and go, oh, okay, I'm in the doctor's office having a treatment. I feel a little, because you can go real deep to a lot of places in the mind, right? And yeah, maybe you're on this adventure and maybe you're in outer space or something and you can go like, this is a lot, right? And
you can get scared.
You look around for sure. And you go, okay, I know where I am. You don't have, a lot of these kinds of visuals are closed eye visuals. And you look around like, okay, your vision might be a little bit altered, but you see you're in a room and you go, okay, and you can bring it back down and go back to kind of that experience. So, I mean, that's something that's pretty unique to ketamine and in the dosages that we're using. Most people find it pleasant. Some people find it weird. It's not very common for people to find it like dysphoric. And I think, you know, that's what I would say to people who are a little bit uneasy about the idea of going into a psychedelic experience.
You know, that situation that you just explained, when they're wearing the eye mask, remove it, and then go back into their dream, reminds me of like something similar to lucid dreaming.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's been incorporated into the treatment, or is it similar to having a trip?
Is lucid dreaming similar to having a trip?
If you
I think there's definitely
well
some
enough.
Similarity there. Yeah, for sure. For sure. I think there's some overlap there. And, you know, this is one of the other things that's kind of unique about ketamine is you retain this certain level of executive function up to certain doses. Obviously, you can go too far and go into a point where you're totally sedated. But within the ranges we're working in for mental health treatment, you maintain a sense of an awareness of what kind of what's going on in a way, or you can be reoriented to that rather easily. Whereas, you know, if you have, DMT or ayahuasca maybe, or which DMT is active ingredient in that, or a psychoactive ingredient in that, or, mm-hmm. A huge dose of psilocybin or acid or really pretty much any of these other psychedelics, you can get really lost in the experience to the point where you don't even know you're like who you are, what you are, what's going on, where you are. And there's nothing that you're going to say, hey, remember we took this stuff. You're just like, you're gone. You're off, mm-hmm. We really don't see that with the dosages we're working with ketamine. So that's kind of something that makes it a little bit more unique.
And So obviously you've been around ketamine for so long and working with it. What's your personal, if you don't mind me asking, what's your personal experience with ketamine?
My personal experience with ketamine? I've tried it clinically before. And I think it's just an incredible treatment. I know what it's like firsthand, as well as the results that we see for our patients after, we've done 25,000 infusions. We've seen over 6,000 patients. We've seen the most incredible and inspiring stories of people getting their lives out of this. It was hugely helpful to me. I believe that it would be a wonderful treatment for most people, even if you don't have a mental health diagnosis, because of the liabilities, the regulations, etc. We need to be treating a condition. You can't just give somebody a drug just to give it to them. So in the US, I mean, we have to have a confirmed diagnosis, but it's of my personal view that most of the world, not everyone, but most of the world could really benefit from this treatment because it's just extremely healing and restorative. And we all, like I said, we all have, or almost all of us have some kind of trauma, stress, life events, challenges, and even just the insight that it can help you to provide by giving you a kind of, you know, objective view, an alternative view of yourself, your life, your patterns, your, you know, that's, it can be really profound. You can have insight, you can have epiphany, realizations, you know, things that can click for you. The effects that are going on in the brain are really actually enhancing brain function. So, I really would love to see more people benefit from the treatment. They don't have to come to me and to my clinic, Ketamine Clinics, Los Angeles. That's fine. They can go somewhere else as long as it's a safe, reputable place. But I want more people to have this experience. I think it really will. And is already making the world a better place.
Wow.
That's an amazing message.
Sam, I want to know a success story. Do you want to mind sharing something? Maybe not sharing their name specifically, but like someone who really like was struggling. They've tried other options. They tried this and wow, their life has turned around. You hinted at it a lot, but I'm curious to hear like a more specific story of how it really helps.
Yeah, there are so many. I mean, we had a woman who I tried all of the conventional medications. She also had ECT. She had two rounds of ECT. Nothing helped her. The ECT ruined her short-term memory. Which is pretty common. And, you know, the kind of establishment, I think, really downplays that when they talk about ECT. But she didn't benefit. And she was really unable to be a mother, a wife, to function much. Really suffered for a long time. And she had infusions and it just completely turned her life, her whole life around. She said, and even in her very first infusion, she visualized a character, like a cartoon character, flicking away the negative thoughts of that she had, all these words of criticisms from family, friends, of herself. And this character just flicked them away. And she said they have not returned since from the very first infusion. And she's a really amazing singer. She went and started a opera company. She's performing. She's a great active and engaged wife and mother. She's successful in her business. And she's singing and performing and is happy being creative and doing the things that she loved. I mean, it got so bad for her when she was performing before that she couldn't be in shows because she would get so depressed and she couldn't even participate. And it was really damaging her career. So this is an amazing person, an amazing story. We had another one. We had an older gentleman who was anorexic and was dealing with being extremely thin and frail and unhealthy and had tried all of the best eating disorder treatment centers and didn't benefit from any of them. He came in, he had infusions, he started eating again, he gained healthy weight, he started enjoying food, going out to eat with his wife, and is happy and healthy and has a good relationship with food. The stories really are endless. I mean, if you go to our Yelp,
go to the Yelp.
Go to our Yelp or Google page. I mean, there are tons of pretty detailed reviews there from real people sharing their experience. But I mean, I could go on and on. Honestly, gotcha. There's so many. Yeah.
Yeah. Perfect. And I have my last question about addiction. People are addicted to other substances, alcohol or nicotine or tons of things to be addicted to nowadays. Does it help for someone to get out of those bad habits?
It does. And it's hard for people to understand this because ketamine is stigmatized and it's a drug people use recreationally. So people get really kind of uneasy about the idea of giving a drug to people to help with the drug. Though we do that with Suboxone and opioid users all the time and all kinds of other things. But, and by the way, which most people I've ever talked to have said that getting off of Suboxone is way harder than getting off of heroin. And it's a terrible system we have there, but that's a conversation for another day. You know, if you have, if you're misusing ketamine, it's probably not a good idea to have infusions. But if you're misusing or abusing virtually any other substance, ketamine can be, in a clinical setting, and I'm not advocating that you start doing ketamine at home. Let me be clear about that. But in a clinical setting, getting IV infusions can really help two ways. One, it can curb the cravings. Ketamine can really help with that, especially if you're engaged in a program to work on your sobriety, whether that's through therapy, DBT, you know, dialectical behavioral therapy, or AA, or you know, a rehab, or whatever you might be engaged with. In addition, not instead, but in addition to that support, ketamine can really help to curb the cravings. The other part is just to recognize that, you know, substance abuse is almost always trying to self-medicate to deal with depression or anxiety or PTSD. So people are using these substances to numb the pain, you know, or to be able to feel like they can go through their day. So ketamine can get at the root cause of that by taking away the symptoms of the depression or the anxiety or the PTSD, or helping people to get closure or clarity on these things so they don't feel as much of a need to numb themselves out with substances.
Wow.
To be honest, I'm convinced. I'm booking a ticket to California right now, man.
Come here.
Follow up, and you guys can share about your experience and having the treatment and what it was like for you.
Definitely. Perfect. Yes.
What do you think, Zayn?
Well, I mean, we've got all this information on ketamine, man. And I think Sam has definitely sold it to us and hopefully to our audience. I'm not trying to make him sound like a dealer, of course. But thank you so much.
I'm a hope dealer.
Exactly. And yes. Your message has been great, man. Seriously, like the awareness that you're trying to spread and the message you're sharing is beyond like what I expected from this conversation to go. And I really hope the success stories that you shared with us continue growing and the clinic just becomes, you know, one of the leading innovators in ketamine research. And hopefully the insurance companies fuck off and finally start paying for the insurance from that. Ali, do you want to sign up?
Yeah, it's been another episode of A to the Show, traveling around the world. Thank you, Sam Mendel, again. This is very inspiring, you know. And if you have depression, suicidality, make sure to reach out for help. And check out Sam Mendel at Ketamine Clinics. What would you, is there anything you want to shout out or plug here right now, Sam?
Yeah, I just want to thank you guys for having me. And, you know, raising awareness is so important, and having a platform like this and you guys having conversation and open and honest conversation about things that people need to know about is really meaningful work as well. So thank you for that and for having me on the show. And as far as shouting out, I would just say go to ketamineclinics.com. It's ketamineclinics.com. Lots of good information. We offer free consultations. Any inquiries are confidential. So if anyone has any interest in learning more, just contact us, please. There's no obligation. We're always happy to speak with you. And yeah, if you're struggling and, you know, this is something you've been dealing with for weeks or more, and you're having a rough time, ask for help. See what your options are.
Awesome.
Perfect. And signing out.
We sign out. Cover. Salute to the camera.